Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. There's no official start date for the 2008 financial crisis, but tomorrow, September 15th, is as good as any. On that day in 2008, many of you will remember, Lehman Brothers went bankrupt, setting off a downward spiral in the markets that led to the Great Recession in this country and really an economic downturn globally. 9/11 in 1 year in that decade and 9/15 a few years later have together determined so much of our personal and political histories ever since. Both the Occupy movement, for example, and the Tea Party movement were in their ways spawned by the crash. Now, our next guest is going to talk with us both looking back to 9/15/2008 and talking about how it's still with us today. Rob Cox from Reuters has some audio interviews, among other things, from people who were there when the crash happened and have studied it and thought about it afterwards. Here's one example. Barney Frank, the Massachusetts congressman who, of course, lent his name to the Dodd-Frank legislation that aimed to re-regulate the financial industry after the crisis. And in his interview, he reflects on the Occupy movement and the Tea Party and has a very blunt take on a big difference between them. Here he is talking to Reuters U.S. editor John Foley.
The real problem for the Democrats turned out to be that the Tea Party movement was much smarter politically than Occupy. I mean, the Tea Party people understood the political system.
And in some ways, they got what they wanted.
They went out and registered and voted in the primaries. And the Occupy people thought they were going to make change by smoking dope and beating drums. And it turns out...
Which they did with panache.
Yes, but drum circles do not have much impact on elected officials.
Ooh, drum circles do not have much impact on elected officials. Barney Frank's cynical take on the Occupy movement. With us now is Rob Cox. He's the global editor and a columnist for Reuters Breaking Views, which published this series of interviews this week for the 2008 10th anniversary. Hi, Rob. Welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to be here.
What did you think about that Barney Frank clip?
I thought it was that interview was quite interesting because Barney Frank was right. I mean, you had this moment after the crisis where you had two movements. They were both outraged for different reasons. Well, I should say they were both outraged for the same reasons, but they had different responses to them. One, coalesced into the Tea Party movement. I think Barney Frank even alludes to, you know, the sort of beginnings of that with a rant on CNBC. And then, it became this rallying cry for the right and indeed the far right, which, you know, really led us to a change in the House, the composition of the House, the Senate, and now here we are with Donald Trump, you know, is sort of at the spear, the head of that movement. And then the other side you had, and it is cynical, of, as you say, to say, you know, drum circles and pot smoking down in Zuccotti Park didn't change the world, didn't actually coalesce into a political movement. I mean, I'm not sure it's 100% true. Certainly, you could look at Bernie Sanders and that sort of wing of the party, which is seeing a bit of a strong sort of movement now, mm-hmm. and could be as mm-hmm. into November and beyond. But I mean, I don't think he's entirely wrong about that.
So, listeners, we'd like to hear from you in this segment, as well as our guest and the clips that he's brought. Has your own financial situation been transformed ever since, say, September 15th, 2008, 10 years ago tomorrow? Give us a call and tell us a little bit of your story. Were you foreclosed upon, for example, as a result of the cascading crisis? Were you affected in any other kind of way financially? Tell us your financial crisis story and where you are at 10 years later in terms of recovery. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In your latest column, Rob, I see you pose a question that I guess people can debate. You argue that some banks are too big. Oh, you pose the question, are some banks too big to fail even still? Is there a clear answer to that question, or only a disputed answer to that question?
The scary thing is, to get the answer to that question, we have to have a very large financial institution, something like a J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, almost fail or go towards a collapse or have a run on its deposits. And that, you know, none of us really want to get there. There is a view out there. So Sheila Bair, for instance, you mentioned, she was the head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation during the crisis, had been put there by George W. Bush. She, we did an interview with her, and her view is that, frankly, that the political system is captured by the financial industry still, so that even if regulators have the tools to allow a bank to effectively go bust, whereby depositors are okay, but its shareholders get completely wiped out, and then those who own its bonds get wiped out, that kind of thing, which are the tools that were granted as part of the Regulatory Reform Act, her view is that there won't be any political will there, that the banks will basically capture and will have taxpayer funded bailouts all over again. But there is also the point of that column was to also point out that in the markets you can see some evidence that the cost of funding for small banks and large banks has converged. It's kind of the same now. What that just means is that maybe the market thinks they could all fail equally, or they won't fail, or they'll all be bailed out equally.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, let me play a clip of that. You mentioned the Sheila Bair interview. So here she is, the former head of the FDIC, who was so outspoken at the time after the financial crisis really hit. She's speaking here to the Reuters podcast, The Exchange. And do we have a problem still of too big to fail? Maybe yes.
You also have the problem of just too big, and too big in political influence, too big in influence over academic institutions, too big in terms of influence over think tanks, too big, frankly, in influence over some of the media. And I think that's what we're seeing now with the effort to weaken capital, which just astounds me, because I thought if we'd have bipartisan consensus on anything, it would be they'd need to have less leverage. But we're seeing an erosion of even that, and it's because they're just too big an influence.
Can you explain what you meant in that clip by the effort to weaken capital?
Yeah, I mean, you had the Dodd-Frank Regulatory Reform Act, which you mentioned Barney Frank lent his name to. There were all sorts of provisions in that, some of which have been, I wouldn't say they were watered down so much as they were tweaked. And there was actually a bill that went through that was, you know, Gary Cohn, when he was running the White House economic policy, got through the House and the Senate. The president signed into action. That was part of it, but there are also movements out there to say, maybe we can, for some of the smaller or mid-sized banks. I think she's mainly referring to banks that aren't the sort of nine banks that have trillion-dollar-ish bank balance sheets, but the ones that are like $250 billion, which is a little bit of a gray area. They've pulled back some of the requirements for capital, which is basically money that they have to hold against loans in case they go bad, right? I mean, it's the best way to think of it. And actually, you know, in the marketplace, you can see that people are pricing a little bit more risk into those banks, those $200 billion type banks, because they may be concerned that when there is a economic downturn, that they have more problems. And I think that's really what she's talking about.
Let's take a phone call. Eric in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Good. You want to talk about your
This financial crisis is always so sweet to me, because today is my 10th wedding anniversary.
You got married on September 14th.
We were in our Prospect Park ceremony, and my uncle started to get texts that something was going down the next day. And so your question was, did my financial situation change?
Uh-huh.
And the answer is yes, because we got a lot of nice checks on our wedding. And we always joke that if we had done the wedding a week later, we think we wouldn't have gotten those nice checks.
Okay. Well, bringing it right home. Mark in Mayo Pack, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling because, well, I myself rode out the recession fairly well. I did not suffer any layoffs myself. I am a public school teacher, and I can say that the effects of the crisis on public education and other public sector employees and jobs has still not returned back to pre-recession levels. In my district, for instance, there's one music teacher for every 1,000 students, one guidance counselor or school psychologist for every 1,500 students. We have suffered massive layoffs over the last decade or so, and many of those people have not been called back. So the effects of the recession are not only personal, but as a public employee, I can tell you that they're still being really felt in a massive way on services that we, you know, depend on.
Mark, thank you very much for that call. And I happened to mention with another guest earlier this notion that certainly has circulated in teaching circles that the banks crashed the economy and society took it out on the teachers. Because since there was this shortfall in tax revenues for all kinds of, you know, cities and counties and states after the financial crisis, there came a lot of pressure on teachers' unions to scale back their pension benefits and things like that. And somehow that's where a lot of anger got focused, even more, it seemed, to the teachers than on the big banks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you hear Mark's story, in Mayapak at least, of still living with that.
I mean, there's so much outrage, and it can go right back to the crisis in so many respects, because in particular, while there have been those who have suffered more, communities have suffered more, tax revenues fell for states and local communities, if you look at the haves got more. So, after the crisis, you had this widening in wealth disparity in the country that I think, you know, has been a root cause for the, Donald Trump support for sure. And also, sort of outrage on the left. And it's really unresolved. And in some ways, you could also argue that the response, the response to the crisis by authorities, particularly the Federal Reserve, in reducing to almost zero, well, it's a zero interest rate policy and keeping it low for so long, really helped inflate lots of asset bubbles. So the prices of, look at the stock market. As Obama pointed out, President Obama in March 2009, he sort of called the bottom. I mean, you've had almost a tripling. So if you're one of that 15% of the country that owns 85% of the stock market wealth, you've done really well.
Mm-hmm.
Yet at the same time, you look at pensions, and if you look at the crisis that's looming in pensions, even though the assets have gone up, the underfunding has actually increased, in part because interest rates are so low, right? So that's the primary guide for returns for these pensions. That's going to hit firemen. That's going to hit, school teachers, everybody at some point. This isn't we have not resolved the depths of the crisis, really.
Diane in Ridgefield, you're on WNYC. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. Hey, Rob. My brother is Douglas, and I met you very briefly a few years ago, and he was a classmate of yours. And the reason I'm calling is I'm actually in the middle of the repercussions of the meltdown. I made a bad decision with a refinance of my primary residence with a bank that folded. It was bought out. It was the loan was packaged together, and I'm still in the courts right now. But it was a no income verification. The documents were fraudulent, and I'm trying to climb out of it with the courts now.
Even still, suffering the repercussions, Diane. I'm sorry to hear that. But Rob Cox from Reuters, besides maybe knowing her brother, So much of the conversation, it seems to me, this week in the media, as people have been looking back 10 years, has to do with the banks. But so much of the crisis was a foreclosure crisis that was very unequal in the distribution of effects. And so Diane, after having refinanced her house, I guess, with the wrong bank at the wrong time, as she was telling it, is one example of that. How are we doing in terms of those people who lost housing? Is there an answer to that question?
We're not doing well. Diane and is one of, there were, I think, something like 10 million houses that were foreclosed in the United States. Now, you could make the case that lots of people, and as Diane just said, she may have made the wrong decision, fine. But in many cases, there was just not enough. And I think the Barney Frank interview that we had, he talks a bit about how not enough was done with the TARP money. That was the $700 billion bailout. it was all went to inject capital, equity capital into the banking system, and not enough went to help people like Diane and others who were foreclosed upon.
Let me linger on that for a second. What do you see today with 10 years of hindsight as the politics of that? And we talked about that a lot on the show at the time. They were bailing out the lenders, but not the borrowers.
Yeah.
Right? And it was, in fact, an Obama proposal, I believe, to help bail out some of the borrowers that led to the launching of the Tea Party, that Rick Santelli rant on CNBC that you referred to before, where he got up in front of a bunch of stockbrokers, I think, in Chicago and said, "Do you want the government giving your neighbors money so they can keep their extra bedroom?" You know, and that's the way he framed it. So there was a lot of political pressure from Wall Street connected people like him not to bail out the borrowers while they were bailing out the lenders.
Yeah, I mean, it was unjust. There's no question. If you had, I do think you had to inject capital into the banking system. You had to stabilize it that way. And Barney Frank makes the case as well in the podcast. And some of the bankers, I mean, one of the persons we interviewed is Vikram Pandit, who was the CEO of Citigroup at the time, a bank that needed something like $50 billion of taxpayer money to keep from going under. You know, one of the first things that Vikram said in the conversation was, look, we can't remember what happened here. 9 million people lost their jobs in the United States. Possibly 10 million people lost their homes. That is the real tragedy here, not whether the banks, and I think that's right. But I mean, our political system, we were barely able to get that TARP money. Remember, there was one vote in the House which didn't go their way. I think the stock market dropped like 700 points.
First it went down because the original version of the TARP bill was like a paragraph, and it gave the government such unfettered powers to do whatever they want in terms of spending money on the banks. And I think people from both left and right rebelled against that and say, no, we have to, lay out some guardrails.
And one of the guys we speak to is Neil Kashkari. Neil was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury at the time, who was basically mandated by Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, to come up with a contingency plan earlier, well before Bear Stearns went bust in March 2008. They had come up with like a plan. And as you say, it was sort of carte blanche. It was actually meant to just sort of buy bad loans from the banks. And they realized you don't get the kind of ripple effect that if you put capital in, you actually can do a lot more with the banks. But look, I mean, this is the problem. You know, the fact that it's taken Diane and others years and years to go through the court system, and we have a pretty good court system relative to some parts of the world. It is why there is this lingering anger. And it's why we have a system that feels unjust to so many people. Feels, let me use the president's word, rigged, right?
And of course, speaking of rigged, I mean, that was more used to pertain to the banking sector's power over Washington early on than it was used to pertain to the way Donald Trump uses it, about the death toll in Puerto Rico or anything else these days. Not funny. Yeah. But that's also why the thin TARP was such a bad idea. I think that there was so much banking sector influence in Washington that if there were no guardrails on how the TARP would be applied, then, the captains of industry could just weigh in and say, give me this, give me this, give me that. Simeon in Hunterdon County, you're on WNYC. Hello, Simeon.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Listen to you guys a lot. It's really great. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the mortgage crisis.
Mm-hmm.
In 2004, I moved to Las Vegas, Nevada, got my mortgage solicitor's license. I was doing it here on the East Coast. I started working for a broker. So that way we would take the loans and we would sell them off. Everyone in the office was committing fraud. It had to do with the 80-20 loans, 80% first mortgage, 20% second mortgage, and it was with a 620 seller with a 620 credit score. See, what the problem was is that you could do 80-20s. You could do all sorts of loans. Like the lady said before that she was in a bad loan, which was a no-income verification. They really aren't bad loans as long as you can, you have a 750, 780 score, because people who get those scores, they pay their bills on time. That's why they have those credit scores. With 620 credit scores, those people never pay their bills on time. So when you start doing 80-20 with seller concession for all your closing costs, and then all they had to come up with was a $325 appraisal, then all of a sudden they have a house. It's not a home. this is a house, because they were buying these houses in Las Vegas on speculation, which was horrendous.
And looking back, why were the banks willing to make those relatively risky loans?
Well, I had an attorney friend that was working for Citi, and she one day, when we were in her house, she opened up a portfolio of loans, and she showed me what they were putting out on the market. They were all subprime loans. They were packaging up these subprime loans, and they were selling them off. I was appalled at what she showed me, because what they were was all waiting to fail. All these people were people that never paid their bills on time, and now they own houses. And I think the reason why the banks were willing to do this is because once they sent them out into the system, their hands were off of it, and it was somebody else's hot potato to deal with.
Simeon, thank you very much. And that's right, isn't it? We talked about that so much at the time, 10 years ago, the securitization of mortgages, all these mortgages bundled into stocks and, in effect, kind of stock-type investments, securities. And the geniuses who were coming out of the Ivy League engineering departments and math departments, not economics departments, and going, and not business schools only, but like math and engineering, and going into Wall Street, came up with these brilliant ideas that they thought were going to make all these bad loans fail-proof in terms of the big picture when they were bundled,
the collateralized debt obligation, or known as the CDO, or the CDO squared, which is a derivative on the CDO. I mean, and then the tranches. I mean, it was. Look, smart people go to Wall Street. Sadly, they don't go necessarily to solve, you know, always to places where they can, I don't know, cure cancer and other things. That's where the money is.
They don't become teachers in Yonkers, unfortunately.
Well, we don't pay teachers in Yonkers enough, right? I mean, that is the problem. And so,
and look, by the way, just to correct myself from before, the caller from Mayapak, who was talking about the problems in education funding ever since, I said, oh, well, then this is a problem in Mayapak, and he wanted to make a correction that he was calling from Mayapak where he lives, but he teaches in Yonkers, and that's the district he was concerned about, just to be clear.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, this is there was so much financial innovation over the years. And one of the points Barney Frank makes in the podcast is, you know, our regulatory framework, our system did not keep up with those innovations. And so this is always going to be the case, which is why you have to give a certain amount of discretion to regulators, to the Fed, to people like who are actually keeping an eye out for future risk. And really, one of the things, you know, this raised a good sort of point to discuss the fact that people are looking at the future and saying, where's the next crisis going to be? Mm-hmm. And nobody has a very clear answer. Obviously, they'd all be billionaire hedge fund managers if they did know. But that's sort of one of the objectives, really, in talking to these people is say, what is it that keeps you up at night? What worries you? And you heard from Sheila Bair saying, you know, any movement to reduce capital in the banking system would be one. But there's just a whole litany of concerns that people have about, you know, where we're headed.
And you spoke, or your team spoke, for your Reuters series with Columbia professor and economic historian Adam Tooze, and he had interesting reflections on the economic crisis globally, not just in the United States. And we're going to play a clip of him sharing a kind of sobering observation on the ability of America back in 2008 to shore up the economy and bring the world back from the brink and where we are today.
If you look at the history of 08, you cannot but feel the significance of the Fed and the US Treasury in a dollar-based global financial system, right? This is what the crisis really reveals. But of course, what are the political preconditions for the American nation state to be able to act as a global stabilizer? It's the transition, right? It's the transition from the late Bush administration to the Obama administration, this very seamless handoff with people like Bernanke and Geithner serving as the segue between the two, and the Democratic majority in Congress underpinning this in political terms. Those are the essential political ingredients of America's ability to act. And of course, none of those ingredients are there anymore at all. There's no confidence at this moment in either the executive branch or the legislative branch of the United States government.
Wow. So if his premise is correct, who would act as a global stabilizer, as he put it, in the event of another financial crisis?
Well, the answer is nobody, and that's what's quite worrying. And the dollar is the global currency, and the Fed sets the interest rates for the United States, which effectively is the level of interest around the world. You're starting to see that the Fed has pushed it back up under Jerome Powell, and you're seeing what's happening. So places like Turkey, you've had the currency decline by 40%. You have South Africa. You start to see some. Now, these countries have their own issues, but one of the things they've done over the past 10 years is borrow a lot in dollars. And as the price of money is going up, it's becoming more difficult. Now, who's, you know, in the middle of a crisis with Turkey, the president has tweeted sort of na-na-na-na towards Erdogan. So you we're not acting as that stabilizing force. Now, I do think that Jay Powell at the Federal Reserve is, you know, the Federal Reserve is a stable influence. It is independent. It is an independent central bank from the president, although there have been, you know, some tit for tat, some comments about monetary policy from the president. But I think that should give us, that should make us somewhat confident. But there's no bipartisan consensus at all in the Senate or in the House. If we got into a situation like we did in September, October 2008, it's hard to imagine exactly how it would play out given the lack of political consensus.
Maureen went away. So let's take a different one more. How about Susan in Queens? Susan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi, Brian. This is my first time calling in, so forgive me if I stumble a little bit, but the way that I was affected by the financial crisis, I graduated with an architecture degree from a nice Ivy League school in 2004, moved to Arizona, started working, was doing great, got a house in 2006, and I was laid off in October of 08. As soon as Lehman Brothers went under, I knew I was going to be out. I couldn't find another full-time job. I was working part-time, but I wanted to keep working in architecture, so I came back to New York thinking there was more work here. There wasn't more work here. I couldn't find full-time work in architecture until 2014. I lost the house, and with it, I lost all of the money that my social worker mom had willed to me at her death. She was a middle-class social worker at the Detroit city social system. And I'm working now. I'm working full-time. I've been doing well, you know, still. Mm-hmm. But the wealth that my parents created for me is just wiped out. And it hasn't been recovered yet. You know, maybe in another 10 years it will be. I don't know.
Do you think that the system, the government, responded adequately to take care of people like you as they took care of some others?
Oh, no. No, I did finance my house responsibly. Brokers tried to get me to take on more loans than I could afford, and I refused to do that. I had a second loan pushed on me. But when I needed to leave, there was one program that might, when I needed to leave Arizona, there was one program that might have forgiven me or aided me in holding on to that house, because I did try to hold on to it. I tried to keep it rented. Mm-hmm. But because I wasn't the resident in the house, you know, the rules were too restrictive. I mm-hmm. didn't qualify for it.
So you fell through.
No money came my way. No assistance came my way. And I repeat that I did finance my house responsibly.
Susan, thank you for sharing your story. What a horrible story. And there are so many stories like that.
Millions of them.
Before you go, to what degree did the financial crisis lead to Donald Trump?
Yeah. I think as President Obama was saying in his speech the other day, that Donald Trump is a symptom, not the problem. And I think that's right. I mean, there is a direct line of sort of outrage that started from the financial crisis. So many people like Susan in Queens and Diane in Ridgefield, people who had struggled and felt outraged because the bankers were bailed out, the rich got richer. I mean, that's just an incontrovertible fact. And so many people have struggled, are still struggling. So, you know, Donald Trump was able to channel that anger and that outrage. And by the way, we also talk about, you know, the TARP was used to also bail out the auto industry. But so many people were affected in the auto industry, the manufacturing sector in the United States as well, as a result of the decline. And I think, you know, he he very effectively channeled that. And as Barney Frank said, you know, the left didn't effectively, but you know, the president, from George W. Bush to Obama, as we pointed out, there was a smooth transition of a response. And I would say the Obama presidency spent more of its time just trying to deal with that, and maybe didn't get to some of its priorities as a result.
Rob Cox, global editor and columnist at Reuters Breaking Views, which has published a series of audio interviews this week for the 10th anniversary of the real start of the 2008 financial crisis 10 years ago tomorrow, September 15th. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More to come, including some breaking news that you're going to find very intriguing.